From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on the show, it's wine and spirits. Find out how making margaritas can end in a trip to the dermatologist, how a medical centrifuge is being used to make cocktails, a geologist explains terroir, a blind wine tasting with the master sommelier, plus, Jonathan Gold discusses Ludo Lefebvre's Trois Mecs. But first, let's head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. As we head into the 4th of July week, we're in great shape because Wednesday is the day before the 4th of July. Everybody can do all their shopping here at the market. And, of course, we want to check in with Amelia Salzman, who is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook for fantastic recipe and produce tips. So, Amelia, what have you got in mind for us today?
Well, of course, 4th of July says grilled vegetables to me. But have you ever noticed how grilling vegetables seems to take a really long time? They tend to go from raw to burnt and shriveled, totally bypassing that perfect stage that you're looking for, right? The secret, my friend, is water. Their little cells need to be plumped up with water so that they can resist the heat of the coals or of your gas grill, while they kind of get up to temperature and do the cooking from the inside out. So with dense vegetables like carrots, onions, potatoes, even cauliflower or broccoli, cut them into the shapes, sizes that you want first, and then blanch them, pat them dry, or just lay them on towels to dry, and either go out and grill them, or what I like to do is I like to do that step ahead. So I can even do it a day ahead, and that means I am really ready to rock and roll. So a word about cutting. You want to cut slices that will give you the greatest grilling surface. So that will help prevent your losing them down the grate. The other thing it will do is it will allow for greater surface area to get more of that smoky flavor, but no more than a half inch thick for something like a carrot or potato, or they just won't cook all the way through. Another trick is keep the grill or keep your food on the medium to medium high part of the grill, not hot. Right before you're ready to grill, toss them with a little bit of olive oil and any seasonings you would like. Seasonings, I would say non-combustible seasonings. Don't use garlic. Don't use sugar-based sauces or vinegars like balsamic. You can add those after. Then put them on the grill. And they'll be done in 10 minutes.
And do you flip them?
Absolutely. And here's another thing that the water bath gives them. You'll be able to tell when the bottom side is ready, the underside is ready, when you start to see this wonderful blistered bubble texture on the top. That sort of gives you a really wonderful mouthfeel and a good eye cue. It's very pleasing. But now when you want to do a leafy vegetable.
Such as?
Well, let's say romaine, like a nice head of romaine or radicchio, or even a tangle of purslane sprigs, something like that. Those vegetables are fabulous on the grill, but instead of blanching them, I just like to give them a good soak in ice water right before I'm ready to grill. First of all, of course, their cells are absorbing the water, but also the chilling, the temperature, means that they can hit the grill and start cooking. The ice in their veins keeps them from burning. And I like to cook those sorts of vegetables after, if I'm going to cook fish or meat, particularly meat, I like to grill those leafy vegetables after I've done them. And it only takes a few minutes. I mean, those big, thick radicchio slices or half heads of romaine lettuce will be done in about 5 minutes.
Now, what about, zucchini and eggplant, the soft ones, the big softies?
The truth is, I actually prefer to roast those. I find I have better control, I get a sweeter product, and I just as soon do that, have a nice platter of them at room temperature, and then enjoy the party in the afternoon and not bother. But if I were going to grill eggplant or zucchini, I would tend to do them whole. Because then the skins of the eggplant and the zucchini are actually the key to holding in the moisture.
Okay, Amelia, that sounds like a perfect not only a holiday, any day of the week. The vegetables, all the greens are all in season now. And let's not forget about all that great stone fruit we can grill as well.
My pleasure.
That was Amelia Saltzman. She is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook. And she's giving us tons of grilling tips for the summer, which is just beginning. July is about the time where Mike Cerrone from Sea Canyon comes back to the markets with his Blenheim apricots. This is a highly anticipated moment in the market year. Mike, you have great Blenheims right now. Tell us how the crop fared and how long we can expect to have you here.
Okay, well, this is a nice crop. It's not too heavy. It's not too light. Probably 1,000 boxes or so, which is, it's average for us. Quality is super good, and the flavor is very high. We are dry farmed. It quit raining, really, in San Luis Obispo back in January. You know, our trees are stressed, and you can taste it in the fruit. The fruit is exceptionally flavorful. It's probably more, quote, a vintage year when it go, from a flavor standpoint. I'm pretty happy so far. You know, the next 3 weeks, it's going to really get going, especially next week. It's supposed to get hot in the next couple days, and here we go.
Now, the beauty of the Blenheims, not only their amazing flavor, consistency, texture, everybody loves them so much. 1,000 boxes is going to take us how many weeks, do you think?
1,000 boxes under ideal circumstances would be 4 weeks. But it's really more of the weather now, because we do hang our fruit. We don't refrigerate it. So we multi-pick. We'll pick these trees 5 times, maybe even more. So this is the very first go-around. We're just touching the very tops of the trees right now, the extremities. A lot of our stuff is still real green, but Blenheims can change overnight. So I'm telling everybody next week.
And the fact that you're picking them for maturity when we're looking through these, and they all look the same to me, yeah. But when the customer's picking them out, you're pretty much guaranteed they're all going to be ready to go. Yeah.
So always remember the Blenheim is one of the few fruits available nowadays that actually colors at the last minute. That's a sign of the old style fruit, you know, that color was not as important as internal qualities. So these things have ripened from the inside, and at the last moment, they change. And so we try to pick them with as little green on them as possible so people don't hesitate, but it also means that our fruit is delicate. It seems in Santa Monica, people understand that, and they pick through it relatively carefully, and they're understanding. It's good to get a little handful of semi-green fruit, because down in this climate here in Santa Monica where it's warmer overnight, the fruit will ripen in your house really, really quick.
Right. And so do you recommend not refrigerating them once you buy them?
I've had really good luck myself right now, non-refrigerated. If you think you want to hold on to them for a while, like you're going out of town, you can refrigerate them. They'll be fine in there. But until you need to, I wouldn't. I like leaving them out. They seem to have a lot of shelf life.
Well, good. Well, this is a story we always like to hear every year. We never get tired of it. It never gets old. And so we're glad they're back.
Yeah, I'm happy that the crop is moderate, because really what that means is half of my orchard will be ready to produce for next year. Because these things do go on and off. So you never want a huge crop on these. You want to have enough for next year.
Well, we love the way you take care of your trees and you take care of the customers, Mike, and appreciate what you do. And everybody's lined up here, and we're all glad you're back.
Yeah, I'm very happy to be back in Santa Monica, by the way.
Thanks, Mike. That was Mike Cerrone. He's the guy who grows the Blenheim apricots. His farm is up in Sea Canyon, and he's starting about a month to 5 week tour here with about 1,000 boxes of Blenheim apricots. Happy 4th of July to everybody. And for the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Find a recipe for Amelia Saltzman's perfect grilled carrots on the Good Food blog. In Europe, the operation of artisanal malt houses hasn't changed much since the 1880s. Yet that's where U.S. breweries source over a quarter of their malts. Brent Manning and Brian Simpson of Riverbend Malt House in Asheville, North Carolina, are looking to change all that. They're producing the first commercial malt in their area since before Prohibition. Hi, you two.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, how are you?
We're so excited to hear that you're doing this. We knew somebody was going to start, and we're glad that it's happening. Why don't you start by describing to us what malt is?
Malt can come from a lot of different sources: barley, wheat, rye, buckwheat. It's basically any small grain that has been germinated and then kilned and processed in a manner that breaks down the starches into simple sugars and makes them available to the brewing and or distilling industries.
What does kilned mean?
So kilning is the process of adding large volumes of warm air to the grain to arrest that germination process and dry it out to a point where you can properly mill it.
So there's three steps: steeping, germination, and then the kilning. So the kilning would be the final process in that. We get our grain from raw barley or wheat or rye from our farmer, and then we will proceed to go ahead and steep that. After it has been steeped to the right moisture content, it begins to germinate, meaning it's starting to respire at that point, starting to grow and break down via the enzymes, as Brent mentioned earlier.
So I have questions. What is it steeping in?
Filtered municipal water from the Appalachian Mountains.
And by respire, you mean it starts to breathe?
The short version of that is it's sort of an exothermic reaction, if you will, where it's releasing energy and some gases and heat along with trying to create its own fuel source so it could grow if it was being planted in a field.
This sounds very much like roasting coffee in that you're working with an individual grain that has certain characteristics, and I would imagine that you want to dial in a very particular color and flavor profile in the malt that you're trying to produce.
That's exactly what's happening. So whenever brewers are trying to get, let's say, a base malt or a pale malt, they're looking for pretty specific characteristics for that product. That being said, that is going to be reflected in the beer in several different ways. It's a little different than coffee roasting where,
the temperatures are a lot lower,
and coffee roasting happens a lot faster generally. Our process is about 7 days from steeping through the germination to the kilning process.
Similar to the traditional malt houses in Europe, we do what's called floor malting. So the germination part of the process occurs on the floor, and we rake it every 6 to 8 hours over a period of 3 to 4 days. And that also helps accentuate the flavor there. There's a different amount of air exchange relative to the traditional air-driven process that happens on a larger scale. And that with regards to temperatures in the kiln, we don't go above 200 degrees for a majority of our products, whereas when you're talking about roasting coffee, you're well into the 400s.
So let's talk about this tradition in your particular region. Is barley a traditional grain, and have you been using sort of older varieties?
There is a long history of small grain production in the South, not necessarily for the brewing industry. A majority of it has been directed towards animal feed. We did not use a heritage or heirloom variety for our main barley crop. We used a six-row variety called Thoroughbred, which was recommended to us by the researchers at Virginia Tech and NC State University based on a variety of factors. We also treat it differently in the field with regards to nutrient amendments to keep our protein low. Lower protein barley is preferred by craft brewers for a number of different reasons. And we've also chosen to use organic certified grain when available.
Why do the brewers want a lower protein malt?
Lower protein malt traditionally is correlated to a less hazy beer. There's a trait called protein haze that essentially comes from using barley that has a protein level above 13.5%. That 13.5% is typically viewed as the ceiling for what's acceptable. So if you've ever, they say you always drink with your eyes first. And so if you have a beer in your hand and you can't see through it, if it's a certain nice light American lager or something like that, or a crisp pale ale, you want to be able to see through it. You don't want it to have this sort of hazy, almost slightly milky look to it.
Now, what about the difference in the characteristics between the six-row variety of barley that you're using and the two-row?
So genetically, two-row and six-row varieties are very, very similar. The growth form is really the main difference, as the name implies. So when you talk about a two-row variety, you've got two rows of kernels growing at the top of the plant at the end of its natural life cycle. These kernels grow side by side in a very uniform array and size. By contrast, the six-row kernels grow in almost a spiral fashion, and that spiral alignment creates some heterogeneity in the size of the kernels, and that heterogeneity presents some challenges for the maltster in terms of how to handle the steeping regime and the treatment on the floor, but then also some additional challenges for the brewery in terms of the milling of that non-uniform grain size.
Could you describe the difference between a brew made with your malt versus a more industrialized, larger batch malt?
Typically, our grain, just because of the freshness, we're seeing, you know, most of our malt leave the malt house after the typically a 2, maybe a 3 week storage interval. Where it's basically seasoning, the moisture contents balancing out. So brewers are working with a very fresh product that is typically still maintaining a lot more aroma. So I'd say that is something where it kind of pops a little stronger in the glass. A lot of breweries that do Belgian styles, the traditional farmhouse ales, really like the rustic character that our grains bring. Rye malt is very popular right now. And when we talk about using rye, that adds a dry, peppery spiciness to the finish. And that's something that works really well with a variety of different yeast strains and American hop hop varieties such as Columbus or Cascade. So breweries have a lot of fun playing around with those flavors of balancing the peppery spiciness of rye with maybe the citrus sort of piney flavors that you might find in the American varieties of hops.
Well, it's been a pleasure meeting the two of you, and it's just really great to hear something else that's being brought back and is being made here in America in a local region.
Thank you so much for your
time. Yeah, appreciate your time.
That was Brent Manning and Brian Simpson. Together, they are Riverbend Malt House, which is located in Asheville, North Carolina. They are one of the first malt houses in the U.S. come back to life. Coming up, 'tis the season for pool parties and beach soirees. But watch out, you margarita drinkers. A stray squirt of that lime juice on your skin can result in a serious sunburn. That's right. Stick around to find out why.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Ever had a burn from a splash of fresh lime juice meant for a cocktail or beer bottle, then laid in the sun? Yep, it's a thing. It recently happened to two friends of mine, actually. It's called, and I kid you not, margarita dermatitis. Margarita dermatitis is the nickname that doctors have given phytophotodermatitis. It happens when certain plant compounds come into contact with the skin, which is then exposed to sunlight. So, during the summer, when lime juice is a popular ingredient in cocktails and beverages, the reaction happens often enough for that nickname to stick. Dr. Rajani Katta, a professor of dermatology at Baylor College of Medicine, joins us to elaborate. Hi, doctor.
Hi.
This is such a funny thing.
Well, it's got a great name, doesn't it?
Totally. And did it take doctors a while to figure out what this was, or did you guys see enough of it seasonally that it was sort of a no-brainer?
Well, I think it depends on on individual cases. It can actually be very difficult to figure it out because sometimes the pattern of it looks so strange.
Because it's basically a splash of droplets?
Exactly. So, you know, we've had people where they've had these bizarre patterns on their arms or their legs, and it can be easily misdiagnosed as other medical conditions or even as things like poison ivy or actual burns. It can be hard to tell in an individual case.
What is the chemical or compound in limes that causes the reaction?
The general group of chemicals are called furocoumarins. The particular chemical, and that's a group of chemicals, so there are particular chemicals, and one of those is called sorolins. And interestingly enough, sorolins are also used in medical practice, so they can be used as a pill that people take to sensitize them to a particular wavelength of light, and that can be used as a medical treatment for certain skin conditions.
How bizarre. Does it only exist in limes, or does it exist in other citrus fruit?
It does exist in other citrus fruits. Now, it depends on the particular type of citrus, but limes are known to have a higher concentration of these chemical compounds. Other examples, bergamot, and ingredients from bergamot are used to make certain perfumes. And those certain perfumes can also trigger the same exact reaction.
I was going to ask you, because so many people these days are experimenting with making their own cosmetic products like a moisturizer using essential oils. So I was wondering if doctors ever see that, where it almost looks like someone's given themselves a peel.
Yes, that's very interesting that you bring that up. I'm actually seeing a number of cases, and not just the phytophotodermatitis, but also other types of allergic reactions to all natural ingredients that people purchase themselves and try. With the phytophotodermatitis, the one that we sometimes see is oil of bergamot. And that's an essential oil that you can just buy at the store.
Wow. What does the burn look like?
It depends. In some people, it will become very red and will blister up. In others, the redness may be pretty mild, and all you'll end up seeing is the discoloration that appears afterwards. The discoloration is typically a darker coloring of the skin, and that can last for months in some people.
Wow, that's so interesting. What is the treatment for this?
Well, unfortunately, once it occurs, it just can take a while to get better. We will sometimes prescribe hydrocortisone ointment to try to calm it down, but the treatment is very similar to the way you would treat a sunburn.
So the best way to prevent a reaction?
Well, the first thing is to make sure that the lime juice does not land on your skin. If it does, to wash it off. And the second part of it goes along with what we recommend to people anyway in the summer, which is protect your skin from the sun. If you are not having sun exposure, you won't develop this reaction. And I should add one more thing, that it's not just citrus fruits. There are actually other types of plants and flowers that can trigger the same kind of reaction. A big group at risk are people who pick celery, because if you handle enough celery, it's got the same kind of compound in it. There have actually been a few cases reported of people who were on a celery soup diet, and they were consuming a large amount of celery broth, and then they went to a tanning bed. And the celery hadn't landed on their skin, but just because they had consumed so much of it, it sensitized them to the point that they got a severe burn from going to the tanning bed.
So fascinating.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for contacting me.
That was Dr. Rajani Katta, professor of dermatology at Baylor College. We've been talking about this very strange reaction that you can get when you mix lime, bergamot, or a couple other plant compounds like celery juice and the sun. We've been hearing about molecular gastronomy, aka modernist cuisine, for years now. But what about molecular mixology? Taking a cue from high-end kitchens like Alinea in Chicago, bartenders, mixologists, cocktail chefs, whatever you want to call them, are starting to incorporate some serious technology into the making of your drink. Garrett Snyder is the editor of Tasting Table Los Angeles. He recently visited Chapter and Verse, a sort of cocktail lab in downtown LA, to see what new gadgets they're working with.
Chapter and Verse is located on the third floor of an old appliance warehouse in the Arts District. It looks like a bar, the name sounds like a bar, but they don't actually serve customers. It's basically a test kitchen for Proprietors LLC, a consulting group co-founded by Alex Day, who got his start at Death & Company, a well-known cocktail bar in New York. One side of the building is decked out with whiteboards, office chairs, standard stuff. The other side looks a bit like a bat cave filled with cocktail equipment and spirits. Alex calls this part of the building the laboratory.
The lab side is really interesting. It has on one wall a bookshelf full of all of our booze and reference books. It has cocktail books from all different eras, new and old. It has wine books. It has food books. It has design books. Pretty much everything that we pull often to reference when we're making drinks or working on a new design. On the other side is pretty much a wall of booze. We have more booze in here than most restaurants and bars have. This is for the simple purpose of having the tools at hand to explore new ideas.
What Alex didn't mention is this formidable looking medical grade equipment that sits on the counter, right between the books and the booze. There's a sous vide machine, which has become fairly standard in restaurant kitchens these days. But to its right sits something a bit more unusual, a centrifuge. It's a pretty large piece of equipment that looks a bit like an oversized record player. So why would a bartender need a centrifuge? We'll get to that in a second. But first, bartender Chris Day of Cole's Red Car Bar, who also just recently got his PhD in chemistry from UCLA, explains how it works.
Basically, a centrifuge uses centrifugal force to create a lot of gravity. It works essentially by separating a homogenized, otherwise homogenized solution using gravity and the weight of all the bits and pieces inside that solution. So you spin it about 4,000, 5,000 revolutions per minute for a good 10 minutes. And all of the heavier particles separate, and what's left should be a relatively clear solution that retains a lot of the flavor.
The two key words here are clear and flavor. Imagine a glass of what looks like water, has the mouthfeel of water, but tastes intensely of tomato. It's a liquid with very strange properties, and it's something that bartenders are going to want to play around with. With a centrifuge, you can create flavors and textures that don't exist in the traditional cocktail lexicon. It might seem like a ridiculous story or even a bit pretentious, but on the other hand, it's a pretty big game changer. Here's Alex again.
Probably the weirdest thing that has actually been successful was bananas and gin. I looked at this bottle of gin, and then I had some bananas, and I was like, poured them both into a blender, spun it around. So basically, I put solids in with the liquid, blended it. Then I wanted to remove as much of those solids again as possible and make it clear, so I put it in the centrifuge. So suddenly, out the end of it comes banana-flavored gin.
For the record, I tasted the banana-flavored gin, and it may sound strange, but it's really incredible.
And all we did was put it over ice, stirred it, and did a lemon twist, and suddenly you have the simplest, seemingly, cocktail that we've done, but so weird, a flavor you would never get. You have all the flavor and aroma of banana, yet none of the texture of it. So kind of a crazy mind thing going on, but seemingly so simple.
While spinning a liquid at 5,000 revolutions per minute doesn't sound simple, it does simplify the situation behind the bar while your drink's being made.
We are finding as more technology is coming into our workflow that we can create something vastly more simple than we have been before by simply front-loading all the work before the guest even walks in.
In other words, you, the customer, are going to get your drink a lot faster if the bartender doesn't spend his time stirring, mixing, and straining each order.
If we can prove that this technology is applicable for a bar, it's justifiable.
Now, by justifiable, he means worth the hefty price tag. The centrifuge at Chapter and Verse, which was bought secondhand, still cost around $3,000 and can only clarify 3 liters at a time, which is a fraction of the more advanced laboratory models. The day I was at Chapter and Verse, Alex and Chris were centrifuging a batch of fresh grapefruit juice. When it starts spinning, the machine can get pretty loud. While we waited for the grapefruit juice to clarify, I asked Alex what other technology he plans to bring into the lab.
One piece of equipment that we should be getting here soon, hopefully, is something called an ultrasonic homogenizer, which our friends over at PolyScience are helping us get one here to play with. One thing that they're really excited about, following on the trends in the cocktail industry, is something called barrel aging. So taking a cocktail and barrel aging it. Well, with an ultrasonic homogenizer, they say that we can actually force barrel age something very, very quickly. So we would put a solution of our cocktail along with wood that we want to barrel age with, put it in this machine. It would very quickly bring on the flavors of aging. We haven't played with it much, but we're very excited to.
All this sounds pretty nerdy or geeky, but Alex and his coworkers realize that at the end of the day, it's still just a cocktail.
While we're using a bunch of cool technology like a centrifuge, a cryovac, using sous vide technology, we're also always recognizing that this is still a cocktail. This is a social thing. It's not an intellectual think piece, and we're not trying to make a cocktail something that it is not.
After 10 minutes in the centrifuge, the grapefruit juice was fully separated. It was time to take a taste. Wow, that is pure grapefruit flavor. That is literally like, I mean, no texture, no pulp, no anything, just pure grapefruit liquid. The only thing left to do was mix up a cocktail. For Good Food, I'm Garrett Snyder.
In LA, you can find the cocktails of Proprietors LLC at Stella Rosa, The Parish, and Rosa Mexicana, both here in LA and nationwide. Next up, terroir. I'll bet you think you know what that means, but a geology professor might change your mind. Plus, find out what it means to be a master sommelier.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. What does the study of rocks and dirt have to do with delicious food and drink? Kevin Pogue's a geology professor whose academic focus underwent a pretty dramatic change after 9/11. He was in Pakistan studying the composition of the Himalayan foothills until the area just became too dangerous. So his love of wine seduced him to shift his focus. Now Kevin teaches, among other things, Terroir 101 at Whitman College and is the go-to man in Washington State for winemakers on the hunt for that perfect plot of land. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
What environmental components affect the way a wine tastes at the end?
There are a lot of environmental components. There's the broad categories of soil and geography and climate, and then we can start breaking down those categories into finer increments so we can talk about soil, texture, the hydrologic properties of the soil, the way it transmits water, soil composition. We can talk about geography. We can talk about the latitude, the angle of the slope of the hillside the grapes are planted on, which direction it's facing, climate, you know, the heat accumulation over the growing season, the length of the growing season, the diurnal variation, the difference between the morning low and the afternoon high temperature. So it goes on and on and on, and we can just look at finer and finer details using those to pigeonhole the characteristics of a site.
Well, that's so interesting because I think when most people hear the word terroir, even people who think they understand what it means probably concentrate more on the stuff holding the plant up, the dirt itself and the minerals that are in the dirt.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate because, you know, that's one aspect of the terroir, and I'm a geologist, so I'd love to be able to tell you that a wine tastes the way it does because of the bedrock rock that's underneath the vine, but that's probably one of the least important aspects of terroir. And the first criteria that anyone should choose should be based on climate and whether the climate is suitable for the variety that you want to plant, and different varieties have different comfort levels, as it were. But the in terms of the soils, probably the single most important aspect of the soil is its hydrologic properties, the way that the soil transmits water to the vine. And there have been several studies done in Bordeaux and elsewhere that have demonstrated that the highest quality grapes are coming from soils that are able to provide a light to moderate water stress to the plant. Soil temperature and the thermal properties of soils are probably one of the more underrated aspects of terroir. And I'm almost certain that soil composition, in terms of mineral content, is probably the most overrated aspect of terroir.
Talk to me a little bit about how a vine needs to struggle a little bit. If we were to taste a wine, all things being equal, except for the fact that the vine was well-fed and well-watered a little bit too much versus one that had struggled a little bit, how would we perceive that difference in our mouths?
First off, if you give a vine everything it wants, it tends to put a lot of that energy into growing shoots and leaves rather than making fruit. And if you sort of threaten a vine with its demise, it starts thinking about propagating the next generation so that it can survive. So it seems like it puts more energy into the fruit rather than just growing a bigger, leafier vine. But when you look at the grapes themselves, it's pretty obvious. You know, if you give a grape, you make it super happy and give it the water and all the nutrients that it wants, the clusters will tend to consist of bigger berries, and the clusters will be more tightly packed. And the skin-to-juice ratio within each grape will be lower. Most of the flavors, aroma compounds, and certainly the color comes from the skins themselves. So if you have a higher skin-to-juice ratio, you'll end up with a wine that's more robust, more aromatic, deeper color, and just richer tasting.
So given this importance of stress and the way that water flows through a vine's root structure, how important is it, or what characterizes grapes grown on a hillside from those grown on a valley floor?
Well, you know, there are a lot of theories about why grapes are grown on hillsides versus valley floors traditionally, you know, especially why the best grapes are on hillsides. You know, and one old theory says, well, grapes weren't necessary for survival in Europe, and so they used the good ground on the bottomlands to grow wheat and vegetables that were necessary for survival, and that only left the rocky hillsides. And they said, well, that's for fun. So, you know, great wine is for fun. You know, we don't need wine, so we'll plant that up there in the not special land. But as it turns out, you know, that's where grapes for great wine do best, because rockier soils, which hillsides, because they have steepness to them, don't accumulate soil. The soil is depleted from hillsides, so you have thinner soils, rockier soils, and that causes hydrologically for them not to have as much water holding capacity. And so grapes grown on hillsides are naturally stressed simply because they don't have as much water holding capacity. So when the soil start to dry out, they'll dry out there first. And especially if it's on a south facing or southwest facing slope, they'll dry out even faster. So you get more stressed grapes on those hillsides with thinner soils that are facing south. Plus, hillsides afford you an advantage, you know, in terms of cold air, because cold air is heavier and sinks to valley floors. So if you're on a hillside, you might be above a pool of cold air in the valley floor. And so, for instance, in the Walla Walla Valley where I live, the lower elevations on the valley floor often get hit by freezes in the spring and fall, but higher elevations are protected from that because the cold air flows right by it and into the and pools on the valley floor. So hillsides, not just hydrologically but climatically, are a better place to produce a stressed grape and a grape that's better protected from frosts and freezes.
That was geology professor Kevin Pogue. He specializes in the Washington State region for winemakers on the hunt for that perfect plot of land. Last weekend marked the theatrical release of the movie Somme, a documentary film that follows four sommeliers and their friends on a journey to pass the Master Sommelier exam. If you pass the exam, you enter into the court of Master Sommeliers, a feat that very few accomplish. To date, just barely 200 psalms worldwide have made the cut. And that's not to say that a lot haven't tried. It's sort of like the wine version of the bar exam. Good Food producer Jillian Ferguson caught up with one of the sommeliers in the film over a glass of wine at Bodega Wine Bar in Santa Monica.
This is Jillian Ferguson with Good Food, and I am at Bodega Wine Bar in Santa Monica with Brian McClintock, who is a master sommelier and one of the stars of the documentary film Somme. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for meeting with us. So first, I just want to ask you about the court of master sommeliers. Can you give us a sense of who they are and what their role in the wine world is?
Okay, so basically, the court of master sommeliers started in the late 60s. I think Fred Dame is really instrumental, kind of the third master sommelier in the United States, really bringing that to America. And I think there's a pretty good balance. Over 50% of the entire court, which started in the UK, is in the United States now. If I could speak to like one of the most important aspects of the court, is basically the master sommeliers train people for free. They do it out of paying it forward, and that's kind of like the whole core belief of the court. We do have like times where we meet together, and you know, you catch up at exams, you catch up when you're teaching classes and stuff like that, and there's this just grandfathered in camaraderie that's there of like, you know, almost like platoon warfare. You guys have been through the trenches. You know what that feels like. And especially for the people who pass with you, there's this kind of like, believe it or not, a lifelong bond going through the process because it's so intense.
So let's talk about preparing for the test, because the movie documents four of you who are preparing for the test. How long did you study for?
Oh my God. Okay, so basically you kind of got to look at it like a full-time job. So, you know, I was working in a restaurant in Aspen the first time I took the Master Sommelier exam. One of the other guys in the film, Dustin, was kind of my study partner in Aspen. Just to give you an idea, we both got simultaneous job offers in San Francisco and specifically moved to San Francisco to study for the exam. And we moved into the same house, and it became like this fraternity in this house. And it was night and day. I mean, you've got somewhere of like in the vicinity of like 5,000 flashcards. You're constantly tasting, constantly drilling, you know, and like everything else in your life, just kind of, you kind of fit it in when you can.
Okay, so let's talk about the actual test. You have three parts, right? You've got service, theory, and a tasting. Which do you take first? Because in the film, we should say that you don't actually get to go behind the doors and see you take the test.
Traditionally, the tasting is first, and then on day two, it's the service, and I believe the last day is theory. You have to have like different skill sets. I mean, if you're like a bookworm, you know what I mean? You're going to do great on theory, but oftentimes the bookworms struggle with tasting. It's more of an intuitive process. And then some of the more intuitive people have a hard time being disciplined enough to study the theory that well. And all three are actually really social exams. You know, you're talking to four master sommeliers sitting opposite a table from you with three white wines and three red wines in your glass. And then service is obviously very social. The MSs are firing like crazy questions off of you, like, name me some producers of Vinaccia di Serra Petrona. You know, so they'll back you into corners and see how you respond under pressure.
And let's talk about the tasting portion of the test a little bit. I mean, you mentioned earlier that people start, you know, they talk really fast and they throw out all these adjectives. And give us an example of what they're looking for.
Well, the whole basic structure of how they point out the assessment of the blind tasting, it's a five-part assessment. So you've got sight. And sight reveals a lot. You talk about the viscosity, the concentration of the wine, color, the hue. Then you get to like the nose, and you're talking about all the aromatic characteristics you get. When you get to the palate, it really becomes structure. So you're talking about like acid, alcohol, tannin, where those levels are at. And then you have an initial conclusion where you're throwing like darts on a board and seeing what sticks. And then you take it down to the final. And the final conclusion is grape varietal, country, region, sub-region, and vintage. So it gets pretty locked in.
And how long do you have to do this for each glass?
So it's 4 minutes and 10 seconds per wine. So you got 25 minutes. You know, and they sit there with a stopwatch. You walk into this room, and there's a stopwatch, and they're just like, all right, when you start touching the glass, we'll start the clock, and then they just start writing everything you say down. it's incredibly nerve-wracking.
Do you know on average how many people pass their first time or how many times people normally take the test?
So the failure rate is incredibly high. We had 63 candidates at the last exam and 3 passed. So that's a typical class, about 5%. The amount of people who've passed in their first try since the 1960s, about 15. But yeah, that's like 4 golds at the Olympics. That's some Carl Lewis stuff right there.
And that's just like natural talent? Like, are those people just wine savants, or do you think that this is something that anybody can learn?
Well, I will say, to be able to pass that test on the first try, those people were ready and they're at a very, very high level. But in terms of like, you know, your ability to get to that level, I mean, if you see the film, it's a bunch of average Joes. You know, we're regular guys, and the average person can smell 10,000 different smells. So when you bring that to the table naturally, it's just about creating a language. And honestly, it's more about using your brain and logic than it is about gifted talent with your olfactories or your palate or anything. It's something that you can cultivate and develop.
Have you ever been duped by a wine?
I get duped all the time. And that's the cool thing. I fall flat on my face all the time. So for anyone out there who's like, oh, these guys never miss. And I'm like, no, we miss all the time.
Okay, so we are at a wine bar. So I figure we should do some tasting and maybe compare some of your notes to some people at the bar here.
Sounds good to me. Let's do it.
At this point, the bar was filling up, so Greg Sears, who owns Bodega, brought over a tray of glasses. Each one was filled with a few ounces of an unidentified white wine. So we took them around to the customers at the bar, and this is what they had to say.
It smells winey. I'm going to start there.
It's very crisp.
A little buttery.
It's light, but it's a it's bold almost.
Sweet.
It's dry. It's tart.
It's grassy.
Fruity, but just not citrusy.
I almost get a little bit of like a peach kind of tone to it underneath.
It's subtle though.
I would say this is a Chardonnay. Oh, no. This is not that at all.
I'll put $5 that says it's a Sauvignon Blanc.
That one tastes like a food, which is kind of weird.
It tastes like it's made from grapes.
I think it's steel, not oak.
It has a lot of oak smell or flavor to it.
If it was red, it would be barnyardy.
Now let's compare those comments to Brian's tasting notes.
It's very tart, very acidic, not any new oak on the wine at all. Citrus, a lot of grapefruit, but also like this melon character as well, like cantaloupe, honeydew. There's a little bit of peach, like an underripe white peach, very crisp. It's not like your golden overripe peach. There's also, for me, like a little bit of skin contact, this like phenolic bitterness on the end. You don't get the toasty, buttery notes that you typically get with like a Chardonnay. I'm gonna say this is from the old world, brand spanking new, so 2012. When I rack my brain, I'd call this like Albarino or something from Spain, Rías Baixas, 2012. I don't know. It's tricky wine.
Turns out he was right. It was a 2012 Albarino from Spain. For Good Food, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Look for Brian McClintic in Santa Barbara, where his upcoming wine bar, Le Marchand Wine Bar and Merchant, will be coming soon. We'll have a link to it, plus a trailer for the film on the Good Food blog. Jonathan Gold's in the studio with me next. Stick around to hear all about barbecue carrots and extraordinary mashed potatoes at Twamek.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. Jonathan Gold's here with me now. You know who he is. He's our Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer at the LA Times, and we love having him here every week on Good Food. Today, he's taking us out to a very special place.
We are going to Twamek,
a highly anticipated restaurant. Tell us why.
Because this is the first brick-and-mortar, wholly-owned restaurant from Ludovic Lefebvre, who is famous as the pop-up king of Los Angeles for the last half dozen years.
In his Ludo Bites iterations.
Right.
And he has partnered with some impressive partners.
With Vinny and John from Animal, and a certain bit of the Animal front of the house staff has migrated there. They're not in the kitchen. I don't think they show up that much, but it's sort of a partnership. Twamek means three guys, and it's like three guys doing a guy place. So it's in a Raffalo's pizza place. And they kept the sign outside, you know, both the tall sign on the street and the neon across the entrance. And from what I gather, Ludo was thinking of naming it Open because there's still like an open sign.
He has a very funny sense of humor.
So there's no sense that this is where you're going. And apparently a half dozen people like pop in every night wanting pizza.
What is the room like? Is it a large restaurant?
It's a very small restaurant. I think there are 22 seats, 24 seats, which is about half the size that, you know, all the restaurant consultants tell you is necessary to keep a restaurant going full time. The parties of two are seated at the counter and the bigger parties are at a few tables. And one of the reasons I think that he's able to afford to do such a small place is because, to the regret of almost everybody but him, you can't just show up and you can't just reserve a table. You have to wait till Friday morning at 8 o'clock where they release tables for the next 2 weeks.
And you're buying tickets.
And you're buying tickets.
We did an interview with Ludo's wife, Chrissy Lefebvre, about the system.
People are sore about it. And there are people who, and I've got to say, I've managed to get in a few times, but it's not easy, you know, trying to get at the crack of eight.
It's kind of like a lottery situation in a way.
Yeah. And a lot of the times you end up at 6 o'clock on a Monday, which may not be your favorite thing for fine dining, but I guess it's like going to see the Lakers, right? If you want to see the Lakers, sometimes you're just going to have to see them play Charlotte on a Tuesday if you have your season tickets, and that's the only thing that's going to happen.
Given that you're buying tickets, is it a fixed price restaurant?
It's more or less a fixed price restaurant. The tickets are $75, and onto that they add tax and 18% tip. You pay for the drinks once you get there. There's a wine pairing thing, which includes sake sometimes and sometimes some other beverages. And there's a nice wine list of sort of biodynamic stuff. And that's pretty much all there is. I don't even think they allow bottles in with corkage. I think that it's important to them that you go with their program.
Because they, with so few seats, they've figured out a very particular formula that will allow the restaurant to be sustainable from a financial point of view.
Right. I don't think anybody's going to get rich off of this, but it's sustainable the way that they're doing it.
So let's get to the food. Let's get to the menu. What are some of the things that you've experienced there? Maybe you should talk a little bit about Ludo's style.
There is only one menu. It's not like you get to choose things. Although, if you're vegetarian, every night there's a vegetarian option, which isn't that much different from the other one. And this is less sort of like a three-star French restaurant that some of us may have been expecting from Ludo than it is sort of a refined version of Ludo Bites, his pop-up restaurant. Probably the thing he's become most famous for is his barbecued carrots, which are carrots that are roasted for a really long time, tossed in sort of in a tangy sauce with orange, daubed with a little bit of yogurt, and served with some avocado and a few leaves of watercress. The idea of roast carrot with yogurt has almost become a cliche of this new style cuisine, whatever it might be called at the moment. And there's actually three or four places in town where you can get it, but this is a really good one. The other dish for which he's probably become the most famous is, I guess you would call it mashed potatoes, though he calls it potato pulp, which is a dish of potatoes that have been cooked just a little bit short of being completely done, put through a ricer, mixed with brown butter, put on top of like a onion sous vide, which is like onions cooked down into sort of a jam, and layered with Salers cheese, which is cheese from the middle of France, sprinkled with bonito flakes that dance in the heat. It's mashed potatoes, but it's mashed potatoes that are done with the care of a main course.
What did you experience following the potatoes? Because I would imagine this menu is quite dynamic. Does it change frequently?
it changes slowly. So apparently, I mean, if you go a couple weeks apart, there'll be enough different on the menu that you'll notice that it's different. You know, one time there'll be, you know, some lovely roast asparagus that wasn't there before. Or one time you'll go and there'll be ribeye cap. When you have a ribeye or a prime rib, there will be this flap that comes off the top of it. And if you take this flap and you cut it off and you use it as a completely separate steak, I think, I mean, Thomas Keller does it to kind of spectacular effect in French Laundry, then it is like sort of the ultimate cut of meat in a lot of ways. And he sears it off and he serves it in what tastes a lot like onion soup, right? It's made with – it's a shallot broth and there's kind of like a black walnut puree and some slightly chewy chunks of farro in there to chew on. It's an interesting prep as long as you're comfortable with having steak served in a bowl of onion soup. There's typically just one protein per meal. It's pretty vegetarian. So the idea that you can, if you're a vegetarian, all they do is basically alter one course, maybe two at the most.
How many courses are you served?
There are five courses, I guess, but there are also maybe four or five tiny first courses.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Trois Mecs, the much-anticipated restaurant from chefs Ludo Lefebvre, Vinnie Dotolo, and John Shook. You can get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by texting the words "good food" to the number 69866. That's "good food" to the number 69866. Don't forget that you can also check out the Good Food restaurant map, where you can find all of Jonathan's restaurant recommendations. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find us on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Thanks so much to everybody who made today's show possible. That would be Jillian Lerrell, Sarah Harriet, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.